For once, I can sit back and relax.
Because John Schramm has really made a point that he is against Bible study, quote unquote, unless there's living word. Well, am I lucky? I have a whole section of time, 400 years, where there's no living word. Whatever happened from Malachi to Matthew, right? Silence. So, number one, I feel relaxed about this session. Okay, so hence the title, Hanukkah and No Living Word. The interesting thing about Hanukkah is that Jewish people do celebrate that day right around Christmas. And as a matter of fact, it commemorates an event that happened on the 25th of Chislev, which we would call the 25th, more or less, of December. Except their calendar shifts around, and I think last year it was around December 12th or something like that. Actually, Hanukkah, except for the fact that they light candles, is quite different from Christmas. And so one of the first things we're going to do is spend a little time just sharing some information about Hanukkah, and that, I hope, will open us up in one little area for being a little more equipped for Jewish-Christian dialogue. This gives me a chance to say a little bit of background about myself. I'm Hans Spalteholz, and I come from Portland, Oregon. And in the last couple of years, I've been involved in various dialogues, Lutheran-Catholic for a couple of years, and then this past year, intensely in Jewish-Christian dialogue. And I must tell you, it has been a revelation for me. I have learned so much. And if you in any way can become involved in Jewish-Christian dialogue, let me encourage you to do so. Okay, so knowing a little bit about Hanukkah is going to help us, I think, take some steps toward better relating to our Jewish and brothers and sisters. That's the first thing we want to do. Now, the second thing we will do is we're going to look back at the historical circumstances around Hanukkah very briefly. This will not, I hope, be dry as dust history. As a matter of fact, this is a most fascinating time about which most of us have probably very little experience and knowledge. But as a matter of fact, it's a great preparation time for the coming of Christ. And we're going to look at some of the things that tie together. And what's so interesting is that all those events are the most unlikely, and they're the most unexpected type of things that would lead to the birth of Christ. And that's perhaps part of the surprise and the gift of Christmas. And then finally, I'm going to suggest that what I'll be describing to you is Israel in a time of acute crisis, a crisis of survival. Will Israel survive? And Israel is Israel with the faith of Israel. Now, I think, again, in that question, we will see some analogies for our lives in our world. And perhaps the birth of Christ, in the midst of that crisis, will Israel survive? Will point the way to some resources how celebrating Christmas as the community of Christ and recovering that meaning anew will help us deal with some of the terrifying questions about survival today. So that's kind of what I hope to do. Now, a little bit of resource material. I must tell you, I didn't plan to give this presentation, so much of this is, in a sense, from memory and recall, though a couple of the resources that have in the past been helpful to me are in our library, and I'll mention them to you. One little book that most of you would enjoy reading and find very accessible is entitled Between the Testaments, and the author is D.S. Russell. It's out in paperback now. And it's a lovely and informative discussion about all those important things that are happening there. Another book that's quite interesting is called New Testament Background Selected Documents. That's fascinating because it puts into your hand all sorts of writings which were done in these years before the birth of Christ and sometimes during the birth of Christ. For example, there's a very famous Jewish historian, Josephus, who lived at the time of Christ and who refers to the Essenes, for example. It's the first time we ever heard about the Essenes. They're not mentioned in the New Testament. And of course, he refers to the Pharisees and the like. So that's a good source. Another source that I found personally helpful is a paperback that's put out by Doubleday, I think, and the author's name is Bruce. That's his last name, B-R-U-C-E. His initials are F.F. Bruce. And I believe the title of this book is New Testament History, but can anyone correct me on that? Okay, it does the same thing that he does, though from a slightly different angle, and I always like to read at least a couple of up-to-date books, and then that helps me zero in, you know, are they on target in their judgments, and where are the tensions and the difficulties and the like. Okay, two more references. One is the three more references. The first is the so-called Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. That is a four-volume Bible dictionary, and then some years ago, maybe less than a decade, they put out a supplementary volume, which has a lot of updated articles. Now, you'll find lots of good stuff in there. So that's one thing. And if you don't have it in your church library, be sure you encourage your librarian to pick it up. Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. It's a big book, about that tall, about that thick. And now two more sources. I use the Oxford Annotated Bible. That has excellent brief historical sketches of this period and all sorts of other periods. Very helpful because it's so condensed and accurate. Secondly, this is good, this particular edition, because it has the Apocrypha in it, which includes a history book called Maccabees. And Maccabees gives us the historical background to the Hanukkah festival. Okay? So this book is very valuable because it's all for the price of one book. It's a giveaway, only $18.
Did you see
it's the Oxford Annotated Bible. The Oxford Annotated Bible with the Apocrypha. Yeah. You could get the Apocrypha separate if you have your own Bible. The last reference is John Howard Yoder, who will be coming to the village, I think, this weekend. His book, The Politics of Jesus, has a chapter dealing with some of the information I'll be sharing with you, and I think with some of the implications. Now, I must confess to my chagrin, I haven't read it yet, but someone told me, oh, you're working on that? John Howard Yoder has a chapter on that. Okay, enough on background now. That's what I have offhand. Now, I'd like to say a little bit about, let me ask, are there any questions at this point? Okay. All right, just a little bit about Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the Hebrew word for consecration or dedication. But when it's spelled like with a capital H for what is celebrated on the 25th of Kislev, or more or less the 25th of December, it celebrates the so-called Feast of Rededication. And now, brief historical background. The Greeks who were controlling Palestine at this time took over the temple. I want to come back to this again, but just give you a brief summary now. Took over the temple. And it so outraged the Jewish people, who up to now did not take arms against their enemies, that they literally headed for the hills, started guerrilla warfare. One of the Jewish leaders, I think it was Judas Maccabeus, killed a Jewish priest who continued to sacrifice. And of course, that meant war. And now, typical Jewish people, you know, you wonder about their air raids to Entebbe or their air raid on the Iraqi nuclear installation, how they plan it for Sunday, right? So that there'll be no Frenchmen killed. And, you know, they always plan these things. Well, this goes way back. It happens in Judges already, but here it happens. Guess what day they reconquer the temple? The same day, exactly. 3 years later to the day, the 25th of Chislev, the day the temple was desecrated, they take over the temple. And they rededicate it to God and to the worship of Yahweh. That was such a great day for the Jewish people because the temple had been polluted. Antiochus Epiphanes had put in can you imagine a statue of Zeus? You know how the Jewish people feel about any statues of God. A statue of a Greek god in their temple? Unbelievable. Sacrificed pork on the altar? I mean, they really were sticking their tongues out at the Jewish people. And many other things. So obviously the temple is desecrated. There's a reference to this in Daniel chapter 11, verse 33. A couple of weeks ago, Don Erlander was here and talked about the book of Revelation as underground literature using code language. Daniel is the precursor of this. And now here's a little clue so you know who we're talking about. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress and shall take away the continual burnt offering, the daily sacrifice. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. That is probably the reference to the statue of Zeus. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. Now, you know who they're talking about, right? The Maccabeans who stood firm and took action and took over the temple. Now, Jesus refers to that in Matthew 24, I think verse 17, and he has a different set of historical circumstances in mind. He says, let the reader beware. Jesus is looking ahead to the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, so this is a rich moment in Jewish history. And on the 25th of Chislev, when they reconquer the temple and get it clean, after that, once a year, they celebrate the dedication, more correctly, the rededication of the temple. And to this day, the Jewish people have been faithful in celebrating this event. What do they do today? Well, from what I am told, usually the mother of the family lights one candle in an 8-branch candelabra, and the first day, 2 candles the second day, 3 candles the third day, the fourth day, down to the 8th day. What kind of a day is it? It's a week, of celebration. It's a week of giving presents, especially to the children. It's a week of joyful celebration, singing, playing games. Those are the activities. It's also called the Festival of Lights for obvious reasons. There is an old tradition going back to the Talmud which says that finally at the temple they had run down to 1 day of consecrated oil. And that 1 day's worth of consecrated oil lasted a second day, and a third day, and a fourth day, and guess how many days?
8 days.
And on that day, they were able to get some more consecrated oil. Now, whether that actually happened or not, in any case, it's an 8-day festival. Its meaning for modern Israel is very interesting. First of all, and primarily, it's a celebration of the military victory of Judas Maccabeus over their enemies. It also has a spiritual meaning, namely, that as the candles are lit and are burning continuously, you might say from year to year, this represents the indistinguishable and ever-spreading Jewish faith. Now, you combine those two, and you think of the powerful Zionist impulse, and you get some of the sense of what Hanukkah means for Jewish people. It ain't a Jewish Christmas, right? But we need to know about it. And I think in the future, if I'm with Jewish people at that time, I will want to say to them, Happy Hanukkah, and maybe talk about that a little bit. Now, that's the celebration of Hanukkah, as far as I know about it. I want to invite you to ask some questions, or if any of you have had some other experiences with it, I'd really appreciate your input, because my knowledge is limited.
I wanted to ask a question about who was it you said killed this Jew?
I think it was Judas Maccabeus.
Well, he was a Jew.
Yes. That is what's so astonishing about this. The whole battle was really Jew versus Jew. Isn't that amazing? If you wait 1/2 a second, let me find here, I've got a mosquito or something.
Were there some Jews that were collaborators with
the... That's coming. Yeah, I want to give you the whole background a little more, and that will show us how the issue of survival is so crucial. Okay, when he had finished speaking these words, this is Mattathias, who is the father of Judas. Oh gosh, the father did. The father of these sons. When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice upon the altar in Modin, according to the king's command. When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal, and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and killed him upon the altar. And at the same time, he killed a king's officer, who was forcing them to sacrifice. And he tore down the altar. Then he burned with zeal the law for the law, as Phinehas did against Zimri, the son of Salu, and so on. One more sentence. Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me. End of quote. Verse 28. And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the city. Okay, that's First Maccabees. You've got to read this someday. Incredible stories. Like, for instance, just to give you a little flavor, at one time they're fighting each other, and the one army comes in with elephants. Elephants! Can you imagine? And one courageous Jewish zealot is going to sacrifice his life. He goes in there with a spear right under the elephant's stomach, puts up the spear, and of course kills the elephant, and he gets killed, but that turns the battle. And that's that type of zealous fighting for their life, which for many people was the answer to survival. Any other questions or comments?
I have a question. It's not related to specifically our topic, but why don't we have the apocryphal?
Okay, great question. We're going to come back to that a little teeny bit again. One of the big things was when Jewish culture impacted Greek culture that they decided to translate the Hebrew Bible into Greek. When they translated it into Greek, they also translated these books, there are about 15 of them, that we call today the Apocrypha. So the Septuagint, as it's called, the Greek translation of the Hebrew, includes the Apocrypha. Now, when Jerome, the great Latin Bible translator around 400, translated the whole Bible, he also included the Apocrypha. He had a little footnote. He said, now these are not recognized with the same authority in the Hebrew canon as the other books. So take note of that. Well, obviously, as time passed, people forgot that little footnote. So by the time you get to the Reformation, the Apocrypha were duly part of the Bible. But that was an error, you see. And when Luther came along, he said, now wait a minute, those are Apocrypha. And in his own preface, he says they are edifying and they're very worthwhile reading, but they are not of equal status to the rest of the Hebrew scriptures. So that's basically how the story went. And today we read them with great interest. If, you know, we're into this thing, like there's a story of Judith and Tobit there. There are extensions to the book of Esther. Those of you who are here for my Esther lecture know that the name of God is never even mentioned in Esther. And so guess what's added in those little additions? Right? The name of God is put in and that story is made a little more pious. But in any case, that's why Apocrypha didn't get in. No, it's not why it didn't get in. It's what the Apocrypha are. Why they didn't get in, that's a little more tricky to get into.
I've had several Jewish rabbis tell me that one of the most fortunate things is Christmas coming at the same time, because really it wasn't all that important. that is, through the ages, until they came in close contact with Christians who wanted to be complementary to the Jews. But Hanukkah has become much more important, and especially in America, because we said the Christians always say happy Hanukkah to them. So he said it's become a glorious thing. But actually, there is that part which you rightfully say. It is an extremely important thing. Mm-hmm.
And different from, really different from what Christmas is about, basically. I want to add something here to that, if I may, and that is this. In my Jewish-Christian dialogue experiences, what the Jewish people say to me, first thing you say to them, tell us about Judaism, and they love to talk about it. Well, one of the most fascinating things for me, you know what they worry about? That the synagogue and everything they do is simply a carbon copy of the Protestant church service. You see? And so, well, they have Hanukkah, we have Christmas. Mother told me the story about the daughter, or was it a son? Daughter of a friend of ours who, where there's a Jewish mother, and the daughter came home and said, Mommy, I like this time of year. First I celebrate Hanukkah, and then I celebrate Christmas. See, you know, it's all just one of the same thing, one nice long celebration. Well, Jewish people worry about this. Judaism in the West Coast is very different from Judaism in the East Coast. Judaism in America is very different from Judaism in Europe. In America, it's so much like American Protestantism that it really worries the Jews. All right, now why, when they start getting more serious about celebrating Hanukkah, is that important for them? It's their own identity that they can begin talking about here. Now, what's interesting for us to ask, to what extent can it be our story? That's the kind of general slogan I've been using for all of my presentations. And I think we can move on. No, someone else had a question. Okay, we're okay. We'll move on to the next part now, namely a little bit of historical background of this whole era. And I've got to keep this brief, otherwise we're going to run out of time. So, I think the most important thing we have to keep in mind here, first of all, is, remember I said the big heading is crisis. Crisis for the Jewish nation. Crisis for Israel. And the question is, how to survive? Why the big crisis? And why is this such a unique crisis? The crisis comes from the impact of Greek culture on Judaism. There was never anything like it for the Jewish people. Let's think about the history of the Jewish people beforehand. Birth of the nation, they finally get into Israel. What's their relationship to the Canaanites? Destroy them, intense hostility, separate, keep clean. What happens to people who have any kind of contact? Trouble. Right? Now, pretty soon, a great kingdom conquering the land, David, Solomon. All right? This little teeny buffer nation has risen to power because in the northeast, the great Assyrian-Babylonian complex of empires were not that strong. Down in the south, a little bit more to the west, Egypt was not that strong. Now these nations are gaining power again, and pretty soon Assyria becomes a threat. But what is the relation of Judaism to Assyria? Enemy. What's the relation of Judaism to Egypt? Enemy. What's the relation of Judaism to Babylon? Enemy. Okay, Babylon's destroyed Jerusalem and Judea and whatever's left. Comes along the Persians. The Persians, Cyrus, sends them home. And so it's sort of live and let live. All right, now we're down to the Greek era. Some of you remember the Battle of Thermopylae and the Battle of, Marathon, where our running of the marathon comes. All right, the Greeks are fighting the Persians. Okay, we get people like Alexander the Great and so on. And he is, in a way, the great symbol for the Greeks, who suddenly, in a matter of about 12 years' time, literally conquers the world. and he also conquers Palestine. This guy was a fantastic general, becomes king at age 20. By the time, that was three, let's see if I have the date down. That's 336 BC. By the time he dies, 323, how much later is that? 13 years. He has gone all the way to India with his armies. He has conquered the Mesopotamian world. He's conquered Egypt. He's conquered everything that there is. He had a great vision. His vision was one world. How did he achieve it in his imagination? Military conquest, of course. Second thing was one culture. How do you get one culture? One language. From India to Egypt to Rome didn't exist yet. Everywhere else, everyone was speaking Greek. Okay. We cannot imagine the impact of this until we reflect about the fact that Jesus spoke Aramaic, but the New Testament is written in what language? Greek. We cannot imagine the impact of this until we stop to think that as Christianity began to develop, it spread like wildfire. How could it possibly spread like wildfire if all the first Christians were Jews? Because under the Greeks, the Jewish diaspora, the spread out Jewish community, all read their Bible in Greek, in the Septuagint, the thing that you had asked about. And there were synagogues all over the ancient world. I want to invite you sometime, the next time you study Acts, do a transparency and draw straight lines from Jerusalem to all the cities or the countries that are named in Acts 2 when Pentecost happened. And it's an amazing star of lines. Every way. How come all those places? Why were all those people in Jerusalem? Those were Jews from the Greek world, speaking Greek, and coming to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. That's why they were there for the time of Pentecost. Okay, so the point is the Greek culture had such a tremendous impact that it, in a sense, dominated the entire then known world and helped the spread of Christianity. One last thing is, when Christianity spread into the Greek culture, it wasn't just spreading into a language, but in a whole way of thinking. So that as people started trying to put their understanding of who Jesus was into words, they were putting it into concepts. Those concepts had Greek philosophical traditions. And they said, God cannot suffer. Because that's what the Greeks thought about God. God cannot change. Jesus suffered. Jesus changed. And so for about 250 years, they were wrestling with Greek concepts and the Hebrew Old and New Testament scriptures, and finally came up with what? The doctrine of the Trinity. And we've been wrestling with it ever since. Why did that all happen? The impact of Greek and Hebrew thought worlds. One last thing in relation to all of this, this is so interesting, and that is that this impact of Greek thought has been so massive on the Christian faith that a famous historian of the last century by the name of Adolf Harnack talks about the acute Hellenization of Christianity. And his argument is that Christianity ain't Christianity anymore because of what has happened to Christianity through Greek conceptual thought categories. All right, now all of this came about through this tremendous impact of Judaism, I mean of Greek thought world on Judaism at this time. Now we're going to have to make this question over here.
I do have a question because I've never found an answer to this. What influence did the Greek have upon the establishment of the synagogue religion rather than the temple religion?
Okay, the way the synagogue religion got established, to my best knowledge, and some of you who know something about this may help me, that after the taking into captivity at 586, right, when the temple was destroyed, they went to Babylon, some went to Egypt. Remember, Jeremiah got dragged to Egypt, and he probably died there. When the Jews came back, they didn't all come back. A lot of them stayed there. It was good business. You know. So they were spread all over, but they had little assemblies where they read the Torah. They couldn't sacrifice. Those assembly places were called synagogues. Synagoge. Is that a Hebrew word or a Greek word? It's a Greek word. Isn't that something? Sure. So they had these little knots of community where they met and read their Hebrew Bible. And by the way, this is the time when Judaism becomes the religion of the book. The religion of the book. So it's a great question. By the way, while I'm saying that, maybe I should say one important point, that during all the troubles we're going to come to, there are three iron threads that lead through this turbulent time to the time of Jesus. The first of those iron threads are the book, especially the Torah, the law. Now, think about Jesus. When Jesus came, what is one of the things that he did for which the Pharisees got so nervous? He broke the law. Now, this is one of the three threads, right, that's going to lead through this turbulent time to the time of the New Testament. Okay, what's the second of those three iron threads? The temple. Boy, did they work to rebuild that temple. Woo! They needed a couple of prophets to be cheerleaders to get them going, Haggai and Zechariah. They finally made it in the year 516, exactly to the date, 70 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. Isn't that something, how they planned things? 70 years. Jeremiah had said 70 years. 70 years it was. They made it right on schedule. Okay, so the temple is the second thing. What great little prophecy did Jesus make that may have helped cost him his life? Destroy this temple, and I will rebuild it again in 3 days. That is sedition. Okay, so you can see Jesus was in trouble. Destroy the law, temple. The third thread is what? The messianic hope. The hope of a kingdom. The hope of their own kingdom. The hope of a king. Now, Jesus comes on the scene, I'm convinced, deeply committed to knowing that he's called to be this figure. And again, does he live up to their expectations? No. All three threads, which are going to be the threads that are wound together that help Judaism survive during this terribly turbulent time, Jesus takes and in a way severs. No wonder they crucified him. That man has got to go. Oh, okay, I said the book. It became the religion of the book. And the Torah is like the foundation of the book. Then there are the prophets and the writings. But in Jewish liturgical usage, when they read the Bible, going through it each year, what do they go through by the time they get to the end of the year? The Torah. Every word, every year. Do they know much about the prophets? Hardly at all. Do they know much about the writings? The Psalms, yes, they love the Psalms. But not any of you who know your Bible will know it better than the average Jewish person. And they really envy us that we think that's such a great book. And they're beginning to read it themselves because they find us knowing it better than they do. Okay, so now we've got those three threads, and we've talked about the impact of Judaism and Hellenism just a little teeny bit. Now, Alexander, you know, lived a very short time, and then he died in the year 323. And he had three generals, and he divided his world into three parts. One of them was called Ptolemy, and he took Egypt. And another one was called Seleucus, or Seleucus, and he took the Syria area. Now, as long as Ptolemy, who was in Egypt, ruled Palestine, things were great because he had an attitude of live and let live, an attitude of tolerance. Now, one of the Seleucid rulers by the name of Antiochus the Great conquered a weak Ptolemy and took over Palestine. And we'll put down Antiochus the Great here. That was Antiochus the Third, and the year was 198. I'm not sure if you're interested in these historical details, but you'll see how things are going to lead up very fast. And he had a different idea, namely cultural uniformity. See the difference? Toleration, cultural uniformity. Now the problem begins to arise. The question of Jewish survival. How to survive? Okay, Antiochus the Great had a son who became king. He wasn't king too long. And then he had another son who became king next. And he was called Antiochus the Fourth, or Epiphanes. A modest fellow. You know what Epiphanes means? You know what Epiphany means? Manifestation. Namely, manifestation of God. I am the manifestation of God. That was the king under whom the Jews were. And now some people said, well, he's the king, and we've got to accommodate to the king. In other words, it's a political reality. Somehow we've got to work together with these guys, otherwise we won't survive. All right? That was one policy. Eventually, those people became, not quite right away, but they became the Sadducees. Ugh. S-A-D-U-C-E-E-S. The Sadducees, right down to the time of Christ, were the aristocrats. They were those who always cooperated with the powers that be. They cooperated with Rome. And when the temple was destroyed, the Sadducee party virtually got wiped out. So you can see the accommodation business was not so good. Now, let's get on a little further with the story of Antiochus Epiphanes. A fascinating story. He was down there in Egypt doing some fighting with Ptolemy the Sixth, and back home there was a vicious power struggle going on between two families. One family by the name of Onias was high priest, and then his, I think, brother or son wanted to be high priest, and he bribed Antiochus Epiphanes to get the high priesthood. Well, people were very unhappy about that, especially the pious people, and they had a regular name for them, Chassidim, the pious ones, because they thought only God should appoint the high priest and not Antiochus Epiphanes. And so there was great unhappiness. Then another fellow comes along, and he gives an even bigger bribe to Antiochus Epiphanes. To the king who was there, who was his representative, and then he becomes, in turn, the high priest. Now, by this time, everyone is in a turmoil over this, and the rumor goes around Antiochus Epiphanes has died. The fact of the matter, he isn't. He was just down in Egypt, and he had had a battle with the king down there, and I believe he drew a circle of sand around him, and he said to him something to the effect, once you step out of this circle, then I will leave you. And so it sounded like an odd challenge, and he actually steps out of the circle, and Antiochus says, okay, I'm going to leave you now. And the reason he had to leave, actually, is because of all the trouble he was having in Palestine. And the insurrection there led him to go back in Palestine and to put down once and for all the Jews. And this is when he took over the temple, and destroyed the temple and enforced Greek customs. Now, what happened? The people who were in this group, though they weren't yet called Sadducees, actually accommodated themselves completely. They wore Greek clothing. They built a Greek gymnasium. The men exercised in the nude. This was all unheard of for Jewish people. Some of the men even uncircumcised themselves. They ate unclean food. Okay. the pious ones, the so-called Chassidim, they later on became the Pharisee party. And I'll talk about them in a moment. There was another group, the Maccabeans, who said, we've got to do something about this to save our nation. And they became what later on were called the Zealots. And they have, I want to read you just a little teeny story about one community there who had still another idea. These were very righteous and just people, and the Greeks came after them, and the enemy hastened to attack them, but guess what day it was? The Sabbath. And they said, we will not come out, nor will we do what the king commands, and so profane the Sabbath day. But the enemy hastened to attack them. But they did not answer them, or hurl a stone at them, or block up their hiding places. For they said, let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify us that you are killing us unjustly. So they attacked them on the Sabbath, and they died with their wives and children and cattle to the number of 1,000 persons. Now, Mattathias and his friends mourned deeply and in effect said, that's not the way to survive. By writing little messages and putting them in bottles in the sand and saying, we were unjustly killed. But you see the issue? How do a people of a faith survive? And I think it's an issue for us here at Holden, because one of the things we're talking about, the Christian community perhaps should take a fundamentally pacifist stand and not meet force with force. Now, here's some people who said, we're not going to fight on the Sabbath. And they just rolled over them. Well, the Zealots said, no way. Okay, 3 years later, they took over the temple. All right, now we've got three groups. The Sadducees are saying, listen, the only way you survive is by playing ball with the powers that be. The Pharisees were abhorred by that. Their answer was, stay faithful to the Torah, the law. And now here comes something very interesting. They did two things. They set up a lot of rules about how to protect the Torah. In fact, they built what they call a fence around the Torah of about 607 laws. Those were some of the laws with which Jesus did battle. But these people were the pious laymen. They were really good people. If you're from Missouri Synod, you'll know that we have a Lutheran Layman's League. I call them the Lutheran Layman's League of this time. They were really well-meaning people. What else did the Pharisees do? They did Bible study.
They studied the Bible, and they had what was called an oral tradition. In other words, the continuing interpretation of the Bible was part of the total tradition. The Sadducees also believed in the Torah, but they rejected oral tradition. What developed in the oral tradition? A belief in life after death, a belief in angels. Okay? When you get to the New Testament, who believes in the resurrection of the body? Pharisees. Who does not believe in the resurrection of the body? Sadducees. See? Oral law. No resurrection of the body in the Torah. But it develops in the oral tradition. Okay, so Pharisees, both of them in a sense cling to the law, but I like to make the distinction and identify the Pharisees with the law and the Sadducees more with the temple. Their idea was keep the worship moving, keep the worship going, play ball with the powers that be. That is survival. What does it mean for a living faith to survive? Do you sense that there's no encounter with a living word here? There's an enormous problem, but nobody knows quite what to do. Some people say you got to just lay down and die. Others say, no way, you've got to fight. Is that the way to make a faith survive? Maybe in fighting for it, the very thing you want to survive dies. The Pharisees said, we've got to cling to the law. The Sadducees said something else. Right? Keep that temple worship going and play ball with the powers that be. Is there another party? Yes. I have an idea how we survive. What we need is true believers, right? That's the problem. Okay, the Essenes. The Essenes frowned upon marriage. Interesting. And yet, they started around the year 135 BC. They are still alive after Christ. How could they keep going if they didn't propagate children? They won converts. That's the way to keep the faith alive. You win converts, young converts. Bring them out into the desert. Teach them the scrolls. Look forward to the day when the Messiah will return. Have a monastery at Qumran. Is there another group yet? Well, if you were at Bible study this morning with Susan, she talked about the Anuim, which were the poor, a Hebrew word for the poor. I've always called them the Am Haaretz, the people of the land. And in German, we have a lovely expression for them. Die Stillen im Lande, the quiet ones out in the country. So we'll just call them the Am, that's the Hebrew word for people. And Ha is the preposition, the, and Aretz, actually it's Eretz, are the people of the land. So we've got all these groups, each of them wrestling, you might say, with the problem of how do we survive. If you read Maccabees, one of the things you'll see in a couple of the lines, it says there was no prophet in the land. All right, now that marvelously describes the time of these about 400 years, let's say, of silence. It's a great hiatus, a great in-between time where people are remembering how great it was to be God's people. And now what do we do? And no one is quite sure what way to go. Conflicting voices, as much inner Jewish conflict as outside. And more intense becomes the hope for a Messiah, a deliverer, and a messianic kingdom, when finally we will throw off the yoke of the oppressors, the Romans who came in after the Greeks. No wonder Paul says in Galatians 4:4, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. Isn't it astonishing how God sets the stage? I mean, it's just uncanny. One other thing I want to mention here, and let's see how our time is doing. If you would study the ancient world, one way to look at it is what one person has called, or a number of people have called, the search for community. There's a tremendous search everywhere for community. The Greek philosophers are searching for it. The Romans were great administrators. That's where they beat, where he beat out, the Romans beat out Alexander. They developed a system of law and order. And so the Roman Empire lasted much longer than the Greeks. And a good communication system. But they didn't have community where people cared for one another. There were the mystery religions. They had secret communities, but they were exclusive. There were the Greek philosophers who had different notions about, we don't have time to go into them, but you could do that on your own. And then finally, the Jewish people who are wrestling with the problem of community.
Aware that they had already had an exodus or a slave experience in Egypt. They had behind them the exodus, they had the wilderness, and they had the land of promise. It's hard to relate any of those experiences to those groupings. Am I just not able to do it? Or is there somehow a lack of the Jewish people in that time to draw from their heritage?
It's a great question, and it helps me to pull some things together. Thank you, Frank. It helps me to underscore, first of all, the absolutely, you cannot underestimate enough the importance of the impact of Hellenization, of the Greek influence. Because you see, it infiltrated Judaism. It infiltrated it. Can you imagine like we as kids used to say, God created the world in German, didn't he? Am Anfang schuf Gott Himmel und Erde. Well, that settles it. But can you imagine, I'm kidding, can you imagine translating a sacred language into Greek? But they did it. That's the beginning of this interfusion of cultures. All right, now, sure they remembered who they were, and that's part of the pain and part of that triple thread that I tried to set up. But now the question really is survival. How are we going to survive? And they could look back, but it didn't help them, I don't think, a great deal. And so various groups were convinced they knew how to survive. Keep the law. You gotta fight, folks. Or let's retreat to the wilderness. Or let's just wait and pray. In other words, the ancient traditions did not have the vital strength under a time of acute crisis and pressure.
If that is true for them, and much of the Hebrewness of the Christian faith also loses, then there is a lot of data for what Harnack was saying.
Yes. Although I want to just put in a little plug for my teacher, Jerry Pelican, who's now at Yale. He was our teacher in St. Louis, who's writing, and let's pray that his life is sustained until he finishes it, a 5-volume history of dogma that, in a sense, is disproving Harnack. Now, it's a very important thing, and he disagrees with Harnack, and it's a tremendous book. You've got to look at that. It's 5 volumes coming out. It's in paperback, University of Chicago. So Jerry Pelican is the name to remember. He's going to write The History of Dogma of the 20th Century. He almost got killed in a car accident about 15 years ago. And so pray for him. Okay, now let's see, where are we? We're wrestling with this problem of survival. Okay, we're not going to get too much further, but there are two important things that I have to say, and I'll get to that in a minute. But in general, we have to learn to think by analogy. Do you know what I mean by that? We don't draw direct lines from this time to us, but we say, isn't it similar to our time? Are we not under acute pressure asking, are we going to survive? And what does survival mean? The survivalists say, you know, arm yourself to the teeth, save enough food for a year, and so on. So we really need to discuss, what does it mean to survive? In any case, Jesus comes along and is born into this time. And this is God's massive preparation, and Jesus, most people didn't even recognize him, but he did come to the Am Haaretz, right? And they heard the song of Christmas, the Lord's song in the heavens, glory to God in the highest. That's one motif. And on earth, peace, goodwill toward men.
They were the only ones without an agenda.
Yeah, and so they could hear what Jesus had to bring. Jesus brought, and you could say it very simply, that for which he teaches us to pray, the kingdom. Thy kingdom come. What is that? A place? No. A state of mind? A way of life. The disciples didn't know it even after Easter, because they said, Lord, will you now restore the kingdom to Israel? I don't know that we understand it, but we've got to wrestle with it. The other thing that Jesus brings, and it goes hand in hand with it, is a new community. Right? Cutting across all of these communities. In other words, these people all had a vision of what the future should be. Jesus' own vision incorporates some of the elements of all, leaves others behind, and brings in a totally new thing. He had some Pharisees in his groups. He had some zealots among his disciples. I think that John the Baptist came from Qumran. My feeling is, this is my own little theory, that when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, wilderness. That's the word that was used for where the Qumran place was. I think Jesus may have gone on a retreat at Qumran. Isn't that amazing? Must have done something like that. I don't know, it's just an idea I have. So I think he had contact with all of these, with all of these people. St. Paul was what? Pharisee of the Pharisees, right? Flawless in the keeping of the law. And what did Paul call all of that when he became a Christian? Dung. He said it more strong than that. Manure mother. Okay. Yes. Well, I had some students back at Concordia who wore a shirt that said bull shirt. All right, but Paul could look back on all of this, and he had made the breakthrough. Okay, lots of analogies to the issue of survival for us today. I think celebrating Christmas is not just seeing how God prepared the way through most unlucky times, under a time of crisis, for his incarnation in the world, but to make some analogies and to look at our world equally under crisis and to ask, how is God's presence incarnate in the world today? Now, it may be an incarnate in a number of different ways, but surely it must be incarnate in the body of Christ, in his people. And then what does it mean for us to be his people in our world today? Today we're not going to try to answer that, but Holden is about the business of raising the question for you. And if you leave Holden without having heard that question raised, you haven't been here. Well, you haven't been here. It's raised all the time. It's raised all the time. I was here for a couple of times and I didn't even hear the question. You know, it's slowly beginning to sink in. That's what the question is. But today we're just celebrating it. Let's celebrate God's continuing incarnation in his people and in the gifts they bring to one another. Okay, that's the end of my presentation. Now we'll take maybe a little time for questions. We can be kind of hang loose because I don't think the schedule's too uptight today.
Not a question, but a comment. On a whim, I don't think we even get a perception of who they were, because we have welfare programs. They were poor beyond the poor that we know.
What did Susan say this morning about, thank goodness it was the social worker in Bethlehem? Imagine all the dumb questions they would have asked Mary. That was so nice. Or in Nazareth. Or a friend of mine once said, can you imagine what they would have done if, with the story of the Good Samaritan? They would have radioed the police, and the police would have sent an ambulance, and they would have had a report, and they would have made it out in triplicate. And, you know. But we wouldn't have the Good Samaritan. Question?
Yes, I've been wrestling with this in my mind in relation to, well, I understand that the Christian church in the early centuries was pacifist. And then I've been hearing about the Anuin, and how do we survive, and what should be the role of a Christian in our day? It bothers me is that we're facing a very dangerous situation in the world today with armament. And then I'm also thinking about Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms.
Yes.
What does that fit in?
Yes.
To this picture, because I hear that Luther bought this idea of Christ particularly identifying with the Anuin. I wonder how he worked this in.
I wish John Yoder were here when I'm still here, because I'd love to dialogue with him about this. I've had to think this through various conversations with Marilyn Fenn and so on, and I'll share with you where I am at this point. If I were a pastor of a congregation, I think I would wrestle for a pacifist position now. That is to say that we as a community, as a church, let's say we were a church together, I want us to agree on this, if this is what Scripture is saying, that we must be people of peace because we are called not to respond in kind with violence as a community. Now, Frank and I have talked about this. Supposing you are a policeman in my congregation, does that mean you can't be a member of the congregation? Supposing Larry is a 3-star general, can he be a member of our congregation? I'd like to hope and pray that if we are right about the community of Christ being, among other things, a prophetic community, and that it is a community that is willing to be for peace, that if we have a general in our community, he too endorses that, but at the same time, he lives in the world where he has to be a general. Now, people here at Holden are going to really maybe disagree with me about this, but at least that's how I see Luther's two kingdoms, which has been misused badly and misunderstood, I think today would be applied, at least how I'm working, trying to test it out at the moment. What a tough time it would be for you as police lieutenant and for Larry, let's say, as a 2-star general to be in our community.
Why did he lose his star?
3-star. He was just demoted. 3-star general, because I'd want us to wrestle through with the tensions and to share with you the tensions of being in that kind of a world.
Well, I think, too, that we're living in a day that is far more dangerous than the Luther's time.
Let me just interrupt. How's the time going? I see people kind of drifting in and out. We shouldn't just deteriorate here into three persons. We should, at a certain point, say we're stopping. When is the next event?
12:30.
How long do you want to go? Shall we quit right now?
No.
All right, I have an idea. Everyone who has the urge to go, for whatever reason, you got to go, go. All right? Thank you. And then the rest of us will have a little bull session for 6 minutes, 6 more minutes till 4:15, and then we all quit. Go in peace.